Today's Thursday, October 24th, and we're having Professor Mirandi with us to talk about what's going on right now in the Middle East. Welcome back, Professor.
Thank you very much for having me, Nima.
And let's get started with the latest news coming out of the Times. They're talking about that Israel, it seems that they postponed their attack on Iran because of these leaked documents. What's your take on these documents and the reaction coming out of the West?
It's very difficult to say because on the one hand, there are different interpretations about the reason why these documents were leaked. And some say that the Israelis leaked it themselves, or at least their supporters leaked it, because they don't want an exchange with Iran. The belief in Tehran is that the Israelis don't have the capability of a long-term conflict with Iran because Iran has much greater firepower when it comes to conventional weapons. Some say that it was leaked by someone who wants to prevent the attack from happening and to prevent an escalation. And that would be a whistleblower of sorts. Some say that it was leaked by the state itself, that the highest authorities in the United States leaked this in order to bring about some sort of change in policy in Tel Aviv. But then again, it could be that the highest authorities leaked it in coordination with the Israelis because the Israeli regime doesn't want to attack. It knows that the Iranian response will be devastating. And that could be an interpretation in itself. So I really don't know. I've heard the different views on the topic. And what I can say is that what Iranians who are in the know say is that no new information was revealed in those documents that would help deter an Israeli regime attack. In other words, the Iranians already knew all the scenarios and they know the capabilities. They have a lot of intelligence from inside the regime and from countries around the regime. You've heard of the so-called spies that they've arrested in Israel. Whether it's true or not, whether they're truly spies or not, I don't know. But Iran has its own means of gathering intelligence. It has methods to see Israeli assets from the sky. So Iran already knew what Israel could do and the probable scenarios. So I don't think that the release of those documents would change anything in Tehran. Interpret that however you may. So I cannot really say what happened. I don't know the reason for why these documents were leaked.
The other thing that they're talking about, if you remember the latest video message that Netanyahu put out to talk with Iranian people, and it seems that they're delusional about what's going on in Iran. And the way that they're picturing Iran, it seems that if you look at what they've done in Lebanon by assassinating Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, they thought that Hezbollah going to collapse. And in Gaza as well, murdering the head of Hamas, they thought the same scenario. Right now, they're talking about the same kind of scenario in Iran. The way that, do you think they're that simple in their mind? Because it doesn't make sense. How do you interpret this type of behavior on their part?
I think that the Israeli regime, contrary to what many in the West like to think, they actually know very little about the Palestinians, about the Iranians, about the Lebanese, and about the region. They are probably the worst Orientalists out there. And their understanding of the region is based upon a very racist worldview. And when you see other people as lesser people, as incapable, as childlike, as irrational, and so on, as do the Orientalists of old and today, then your analysis is going to be tainted. And of course, Western media, Western think tanks, because there is this long-lasting legacy of exceptionalism and a sense of superiority and European superiority and Eurocentricism and American exceptionalism, this sort of analysis fits well into their worldview, and it's easily accepted. When Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was martyred, I was in Beirut, as you know, and I went there a day or two before. And in the media, I was saying, in the many interviews that I did, that this is not going to weaken Hezbollah. It's going to strengthen Hezbollah, because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is going to become even more popular, and Hezbollah is going to become even more popular across the region and across the world. But I think they probably listened to me and said these are empty words. And the same is true about the martyrdom of Ismail Haniyeh and the martyrdom of all of the commanders of the resistance. Sinwar, Yahya, the martyrdom of Sanyan Sinwar was actually, I think, a good example of the stupidity of the Israelis, because they put out the clip of his martyrdom thinking that he would be humiliated. And the exact opposite happened. Why? It's because they don't understand how the rest of the world thinks. They don't understand how the region thinks. They don't understand. They, since they see themselves as superior and everyone else as inferior, their interpretations of reality are completely distorted. And that's why I think when they attacked Hezbollah in Lebanon, I thought that probably Netanyahu knew that he would fail. And he is failing. It's been almost 4 weeks now. And they're desperately trying to advance into Lebanon. And they're taking huge casualties, including this morning. Hezbollah is really hitting them hard. But now I'm beginning to think that maybe Netanyahu did think that he could just roll over or go right over Hezbollah and finish the job. Hezbollah is, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is the pillar of resistance in that part of the world. But he trained generations of people, and he helped young people in Hamas, in Hezbollah, in Islamic Jihad, and elsewhere in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria, to become a part of the resistance, to become prepared for war. But they are, these different resistance groups are sophisticated organizations now, with highly motivated and highly intelligent and highly educated people involved. So Yahya Sinwar or Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, or now the commanders that we will be, that are fighting in the field, who will obviously be facing martyrdom in the days and weeks ahead, or the martyr Sayyid Hashim Safiuddin, all of these people, they're going to be more and more martyrs and casualties. But Israel is not going to win the war. It's doing the exact opposite. It is mobilizing public opinion in favor of the resistance group, and the different resistance groups. So imagine what the mood is now in Jordan, despite the existence of a police state. Imagine what the mood is in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, even in a country like Turkey, which is more, public opinion is acknowledged to a greater degree through democracy. Imagine the mood right now as the Israelis murder these leaders. Yahya Sinwar, is he the Yahya Sinwar of 2 weeks ago? No. Is Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah the? No, he's not what he was before. He's much larger. But they can't see this, and they are going to pay the price. Hezbollah, as I may have said on your show before, Hezbollah has not lost any of its military capability, because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has spent 20 years in developing this underground network across the country. So we're seeing them firing heavy missiles at Israel from those underground bases. We see that from those underground tunnels, they're attacking Israeli tanks and Israeli infantry. The infantry now, they've been losing so many tanks that now they're not using their tanks. Over the last couple of days, they've been sending in more infantry, but they're still taking heavy losses. So Hezbollah has been fully prepared. Yes, the Israeli regime, in their initial airstrikes, they were able to take out leaders, which is not extraordinary, because they had 2 decades to gather intelligence, Western embassies, AWACS planes, drones flying alongside the Mediterranean, the Five Eyes, Western NGOs in Beirut. You know, they've been active, so they could find some places under Beirut, especially a place like Beirut, which is by the sea, and the tunnels there are different from the tunnels that are under mountains and across the country. So yes, that Beirut was there, always going to be their weakest link. But now their commanders are well protected, their leaders are well protected, they're in fighting mode, and the Israelis have a very painful battle to fight in the days and weeks ahead. But I think that, going back to your question, I think that they don't understand our region, the Israeli regime, and any racist. It's like the Israeli regime is like the slave owners of the American South, who underestimate their slaves, who see them as inferior. And they are, when the time comes, they're always shocked and surprised.
If you remember, before October 7, everybody, whenever they were talking in the West, they were talking about Israel. Israel is so powerful in terms of intelligence, in terms of military, and the picture they were giving us about Israel. And right now, after a year in this conflict in the Middle East, how do you see the capabilities of Israel in terms of intelligence, in terms of military? We saw that 2 Iranian attack on Israel, they were incapable of shooting down the main missiles that they could hit the targets in Israel. Right now, Hezbollah is attacking by drones Prime Minister's house in Israel. How do you see this? Because whenever they're talking in Israel, the Netanyahu administration, he's talking about our security is our priority. What has happened to Israel's security in their eyes, in your opinion?
Well, one thing that I'd like to add first is that when the leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, went to Friday prayers, that was at a time when there were lots of rumors that the Israeli regime was going to strike. And Western media was putting out this fake information that they removed, that he was taken from his office or his place of residence and taken elsewhere, and that sort of nonsense. And so he went to the Friday prayers. He went earlier because they had a ceremony for the martyrdom of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Then he said the Friday prayers, and afterwards he stayed there and met people. And there was an unprecedented crowd in Tehran for those Friday prayers, because people felt that there was a threat. Because people thought that there may be airstrikes or drone strikes or missile strikes on Tehran. So this is something that the Israeli regime, again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, they simply do not comprehend the region. They do not comprehend Iran. They do not comprehend Hezbollah. They do not comprehend Hamas. They don't understand Ansarullah in Yemen or Islamic Jihad or the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces. They can't comprehend them because their assessment is based upon ethno-supremacism. And since the West has, as I said earlier, this Eurocentric and an exceptionalist worldview, they are all their analysis, their views, their analyses on the region, they're compatible with one another. And so they're always going to get it wrong. They're always going to miscalculate. So that's one issue. The second is that first we have to remember that the Israeli regime, as we are speaking, is fighting with American weapons, European weapons, American ammunition, European ammunition, American assistance, European assistance, American intelligence, European intelligence. They're not fighting this war by themselves. The heavy lifting, despite all this, going back to the issue of the missile strikes, the Iranian missile strikes, even then, the heavy lifting was being done by the Americans, directly by the Americans, American naval ships and the American Air Force or the American air power. Despite all that, the regime is floundering. Again, over a year in Gaza, have they been able to take any part of Gaza? They're imposing starvation in the north, as we all know, with Western support. Have no doubt that Western media, if they wanted to stop this, Western media could stop it. They would be screaming about genocide day and night. If they just did that for 3-4 days, it would stop. Just Western media. If the BBC and CNN, forget Fox News and The Guardian and everyone, if just the BBC and CNN focus on the Holocaust in northern Gaza, the starvation siege, and the constant bombing and massacres that are taking place just in northern Gaza for 3-4 days, they back down, have no doubt. So the West and the Israelis are imposing a starvation siege. They've slaughtered, who knows, maybe 200,000 people directly and indirectly. Who knows how many people are under the rubble and have not been counted? Who knows how many people have died of cancer and illness and who've died because there's no medicine? Who knows? They've succeeded in carrying out a genocide. But they have not been able to take Gaza. And this is after a full year. This is the same Israeli regime that would go all the way to the Suez Canal once upon a time, that would go all the way to Beirut and take the city once upon a time, that went and took the Golan and the West Bank. Now they cannot take Gaza. Now, on the border with Lebanon, they have tens of thousands of forces trying to penetrate into Lebanon, and they're facing heavy casualties, despite overwhelming air power, because Hezbollah has over decades created a sophisticated underground capability across Lebanon, especially southern and central Lebanon. So I think that the Israeli regime has definitely been diminished in the eyes of the world. Its military capabilities, I think, have been exposed. Its intelligence capabilities have been exposed, all of them as being exaggerated. And they are just desperately clinging on to Western support to continue these mass murders. I mean, I've lived in Beirut. They bomb banks. They know those banks they contain the money of the people. They want to impoverish people, especially they're focusing on the supporters of the resistance, the communities that support the resistance. They want to impoverish. They're bombing apartment blocks, not because there's anyone in them, because they want to destroy people's houses. They want to destroy shops. They want to make them impoverished permanently. They want to destroy society, just like what they're doing in Gaza. And the West is completely supportive of this. Western journalists are in Beirut. Many of them. There are a few good people among them. A few. Yeah, very few. But most of them, overwhelmingly, they know what's going on, but that's not how they're going to report it. They're going to say these are Hezbollah strongholds, Hezbollah targets. They know they're just targeting houses. Every time you see a heavy strike on Beirut or on other cities in Lebanon, you can be certain that they suffered a major blow on the border. Hezbollah killed a number of their soldiers. They go and take it out on the people. So whenever you see a huge wave of airstrikes on Beirut, you can be sure that something bad happened on the border. And this is what Western journalists know, because they know enough about Beirut, those who are there, to know that these are not military targets that are being destroyed. They know that, but they work for corporate media. They work for legacy media, and legacy media is never going to stand against the Israeli regime. But the fact is that people who watch the scenes, ordinary people, they're not stupid. When they see a huge apartment tower just come down, there's no way that anyone is going to be able to justify it by saying they have gold underneath, or, you know, the nonsense that the Israelis have been saying about the hospitals now. It's so outrageous that a couple of Western journalists, you know, Hezbollah took them, or, you know, the resistance took them to see those hospitals so that they would, you know, as I said, maybe there are a few journalists who are decent or half decent. So people across the world are seeing this. Israel is despised across the world. Is that a victory? If an Israeli wants to travel to China and says, "I'm an Israeli tourist," do you think people, you know, when people look down upon them and look at them with disgust, that's not going to have an impact on the future of Israel, on the future of how they identify themselves, and perhaps where they choose to live in future? So the regime has been diminished completely, and its image has been shattered, both as a capable military, but also as a so-called liberal democracy, whatever that means, because the whole West is involved in this genocide. And whether they like it or not, today Iran, you know, the country which is the most antagonized in the world, is looked upon favorably across the global South, or the global majority, as some say. Hezbollah, Hamas, the resistance, Ansarullah, they're seen in a very different light across the region and beyond. And the West, it's seen as an accomplice to this genocide. So everything has changed in this year. Everything has changed. And I think this, when we look at what's happening in Kazan and the BRICS summit, this has an impact on that, because it only acts as a catalyst for the rest of the world, who wants to have less to do with the West, who wants to be less dependent on the West, who wants to be less reliant on the West, because they see the West as not the civilized world. They see the West as the biggest threat to the civilized world.
Yeah. As recently we had the U.S. envoy Hochstein to Lebanon talking with military and political figures. On the other hand, Antony Blinken was in Israel talking with Netanyahu. Do you think, when you look at the Biden administration right now and the way that they're trying to implement their policy in that region, do you think that they're trying to manage the situation? Are they trying to convince Lebanese, make some sort of fracture, make some sort of division within Lebanon? Because they're still hoping that they can, this division would benefit Israel in the long term?
Again, it's difficult to say, because I don't know what goes on in the minds of these people, and maybe they are divided. Like I said earlier, I thought Netanyahu knew he would be defeated in Lebanon. But then upon thinking about it more, I concluded that perhaps he thought he would be an easy victory, murdering or the martyrdom of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and senior commanders in that initial shock and awe wave. Maybe he thought that, you know, these are just these Orientals and they would fall apart and they were just following a charismatic leader, you know, a man whose son was martyred for the cause, is an excellent speaker, a highly educated person, he had all the characteristics that one would like to see in a leader. And with him gone, everything falls, because these people, they're just brown people and they're Orientals and they don't know how to organize. Maybe he saw it that way. And maybe that's what the West thought too. They didn't comprehend that this is a very sophisticated organization, as I said earlier, with very sophisticated young people in it and highly motivated and educated people who have brought this together. And they're going to be more motivated than before to defeat the enemy. So I don't know what the policy of the United States is, but let's go back to 2006 when they... when it was said that these are the when the Israeli regime launched their attack on Lebanon, the Western media was saying Hezbollah is being defeated and the Israelis are winning the war. That's what we're hearing the whole time in 2006. And then Condoleezza Rice went and said the birth pangs of a new Middle East. Well, 18 years later, we're hearing the same thing. What happened then? I think we're going to see the same thing happen again now. The only difference is that the defeat today will be much greater than in 2006, because the West, the collective West, meaning the Western political order, the political establishment, which increasingly ordinary people in the West are recognizing to be authoritarian and dangerous, despotic and brutal, the collective West has put all its eggs in the basket of the Israeli regime, just like they've done in Ukraine. And we see what's happening in Ukraine today. A never-ending crisis. I personally don't think that the crisis in Ukraine is going to go away either, because the collective West has invested too much in this. And even if, for example, Trump comes to power, how is he going to end the war? Russia is not going to set aside its demands after all these sacrifices for the sake of Trump. Russia says that I've made these sacrifices, I'm winning the war, these are my demands. If Trump accepts, he's humiliated. If he doesn't, then we have a continuation of the crisis. Here, the collective West has invested everything in this genocide, in this regime. Much more than in 2006. So the defeat ultimately will be much greater for the West, especially, as I said earlier, because the West is seen as invested in the genocide. The West is behind the genocide. The West is a partner in this genocide. As I said earlier, just forget Gaza, forget the ongoing massacres and the starvation that we've seen for over a year in Gaza. Right now in northern Gaza, they are starving northern Gaza. They are starving northern Gaza. Everyone knows this. Everyone knows this. And they're pounding northern Gaza as they starve them. Everyone knows this. If the BBC and CNN suddenly went and focused on northern Gaza, do you think that the Israelis would be able to continue this for 3 days? The U.S. government would have to step in. Trump would have to step in. The whole political establishment would have to step in. But they don't do that because they're all in this together. This notion of freedom and democracy and checks and balances and the fourth estate and the fifth estate and the tenth estate, it's all nonsense. It's all a joke. So the West has destroyed itself. The West has diminished itself. And therefore, I think that either they foolishly think, like in 2006, that they're going to win because Hezbollah, or they know that they are not going to win, but they still do it anyway. Or there are some who think it's mixed. Some think, you know, I mean, Ukraine began earlier. From day I was in Vienna, during the nuclear negotiations. When the war started, a very famous journalist was based there, and he was focusing on the nuclear talks. I won't name him. If I name even his media outlet, it'll be clear who it is. He specialized on the nuclear program. That's what we had long discussions about the war. And I said that Russia will win. And he was certain that Russia will lose. And the reason why I was arguing with him that, you know, you need a deal with Iran. You're going to have an energy crisis. This is going to be a long and painful war for the West. But, you know, he didn't accept. A year later, actually, he sent me a message and saying, I was thinking about what you were saying in Vienna. But, you know, recently, so his views did evolve, apparently. But the point is that we knew this. It wasn't just me, it was many of us. We knew that they were not going to be able to turn the ruble into rubble. They couldn't overthrow Iran. They couldn't overthrow Syria. They couldn't overthrow Venezuela. How are they going to overthrow Russia? But I think that many of these people thought they could because they live in that bubble in Washington or in London or in Paris or in Berlin. And many others probably knew better. But still, when the political establishment says, this is where we go, that's where you get your funding. That's how you get a good life. That's how you keep your job. You just remain quiet and do what it is you have to do. So I don't know. I don't know whether American policy in Lebanon is based on the fact that they really think the Israeli regime will be victorious, and they send an Israeli citizen to negotiate on behalf of the U.S. government? Or is it that they know that things are not going well, but like in Ukraine, that's the only path that they recognize? Or there's an argument and debate going on inside the United States. But I think ultimately they're going to have to acknowledge defeat, because there will be an end to this war at some point. It may not be soon, but it will end. And if the Israeli regime does not achieve victory, it has lost. If the Israeli regime does not achieve victory, it is lost. And if it loses, that is the end of Israel. Not overnight, not within a month or two, but that's the end of Israel. Because the aura, the everything about Israel, all that the mythology of Israel will collapse. So Israel has to win, and I see no path to victory.
When we look at the conflict in Ukraine, as you've mentioned, recently there were some discussions, if you remember, that Stormer went to the United States, had a meeting with Biden about sending these long-range missiles to Israel, to Ukraine to fight Russia. And in those days, it seems that Pentagon had the upper hand in the United States to manage the situation, not to let these missiles getting into Ukraine because of the fear they had to escalations. Right now, with these leaked documents in the Middle East talking about the conflict between Iran and Israel, do you think the same type of mindset is just managing the situation? Because when considering all of this, and recently Donald Trump had an interview on a podcast, an Iranian American podcast called Patrick Ben David, and
the blind leading the blind.
And Donald Trump was talking about that, I want Iran to be prosperous. I don't want any sort of war with Iran. But the only thing would be the nuclear energy program of Iran. he was the one that withdrew from the agreement between Iran and the United States. How do you think that what's going on right now with Israel in the Middle East, that they know that Israel is losing? That's why Trump is changing his tone against Iran. Is he going to change the U.S. foreign policy if he wins toward Iran, or it's all delusional? And we know at the end of the day, the Israeli lobby is much more powerful.
There's no easy answer for this, because Trump is a very impulsive person. He says very different things at different times. He has also been the reason why Iran has developed its nuclear program so extensively, because he tore up the nuclear deal. Of course, Obama didn't abide by the commitments that the U.S. made after signing the deal, but Trump tore it up, and Iran did the right thing and began to expand its nuclear program again, and very rapidly. And now Iran is a threshold state. Its program is peaceful, but as the former foreign minister, Dr. Kamal Kharrazi, said twice, and he's an advisor to the leader, that if there's a nuclear threat to Iran, Iran's nuclear posture will change. He said that, you know, he never withdrew that statement. It was never criticized. He never retracted. So obviously that means that he spoke on authority. So Trump himself pushed Iran towards a more expanded nuclear program, although a peaceful program. And Iran could create a nuclear weapon very easily. If Iran wanted a nuclear weapon, Iran could have made a nuclear weapon 15 years ago. But Iran has decided not to do so. Why? Because nuclear weapons are not good for the stability of the region. If Iran develops a nuclear weapon, then Saudi Arabia would want one, then Turkey would want one, then Egypt would want one, then Central Asian countries would, and then, you know, who knows if some coup d'etat happens somewhere and then some madman comes to power in some country, what will happen in our region? So a nuclear weapon is not a good thing in general. But the Iranians are a threshold state. And by being a threshold state, they're making this statement that, look, don't threaten us. And we keep in mind that Iran's peaceful nuclear program is well protected. All of Iran's key assets are well protected. Because Iran has been preparing itself not for an Israeli strike. It's been preparing itself for decades for an American attack. And the Americans are much more powerful than the Israelis. The Israelis, if it was a one-on-one with Iran, the Iranians would defeat them easily. Iran can fire wave after wave after wave of missiles and drones, thousands and thousands, and just crush the regime from their underground bases, well-protected underground bases. Those bases were all created, those underground cities, to defend the country against the Americans. Remember, the Americans were in Iraq, they were in Afghanistan, they were across the Persian Gulf. Someone once said, real men go to Tehran. That's what the Iranians were preparing themselves for. So I think that whether it's Donald Trump or Harris, they do recognize, I mean, there are sane people in Washington in the military who do recognize that a war with Iran would be devastating for the United States and the interests of the United States. And those people are usually in the military. At least that's my understanding in the past. And the same people, as you rightly pointed out, they're the ones who have probably been trying to find a better way forward in Ukraine. But again, the politicians and the military industrial complex and the big money, they took the United States in a different direction. So yes, I think that it is possible to interpret the leak, if that's what you're alluding to, the leak to what they did with regards to Ukraine to block strikes deep into Russia. But that is one interpretation. I don't know the answer. Again, it could be that the Israeli regime itself felt that it is incapable of having some sort of missile and exchange with Iran without losing. And so someone close to the Israelis leaked it, or the U.S. government with the consent of the Israelis leaked it. That is also a possibility. Or perhaps it was a whistleblower. I have no idea. But that I am certain that regardless of what the motivations were for the leak, I am absolutely certain that there are lots of people in the U.S. military who do understand that a war between the United States and Iran is not a war that the Americans can win. It would be devastating for the whole globe. It would mean an end to the global economy as we know it.
When you look at right now, the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia, yesterday we learned that they're talking about a joint naval drills in the Red Sea. And how do you find the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia comparing with what it was a year before, 2 years ago?
Obviously, it's better. But Saudi Arabia has many problems. One is that it's invested in huge programs that I think are black holes, like NEOM and all that, you know, these projects, these mega projects that I think are just corruption and that will take the country's resources and just, you know, and destroy their assets. Then a lot of their assets are in the United States. 800 billion or so, I think, in treasuries, I think. You know, they have a lot of their money is in the West, and they're never going to see that money again, by the way. So they are, and the princes and the elites in Saudi Arabia, they have bank accounts in the West, they have palaces and apartments in the West. Their children study there. They have studied there. The West has all sorts of information on each and every one of them. You know, what prostitutes they may have visited, or what, you know, what sort of weaknesses they may have. The United States has all sorts of information on these people. But also there's this, you know, historic and cultural affinity to the West. You know, they as I said, they spend their vacations in Western countries usually. So separating Saudi Arabia from the United States is not something that can be done easily. But Saudi Arabia feels very vulnerable. They saw after what happened to their oil installations a few years ago in the drone attack on Aramco. They saw how vulnerable they are. They see how the United States is getting weaker. They're not fools. They see that. Whether it's in West Asia or in Ukraine or in their economic rivalry with China, they see that the United States is declining. They see Europe declining rapidly. So they're, in a sense, they want to stay out of trouble. They don't want trouble with Iran. They want improved ties with Iran. They want improved ties with Russia. But see how ambivalent they are towards BRICS. Mohammed bin Salman did not travel to Kazan, and the foreign minister went. And we still don't know if Saudi Arabia is in or out. I mean, Argentina, they just said, we're out, but Saudi Arabia hasn't really made a decision. So they want improved relations with China, economic relations. But I don't think that Saudi Arabia can distance itself from the U.S. camp. It is bound to the United States. And that, ironically, is what makes it more vulnerable, because there's no doubt that Saudis are overwhelmingly against the Israeli regime. But Saudi media has been gloating over the martyrdom of the leader of Hamas. And people adore the resistance. Yahya Sinwar, especially the Israelis, made him more popular by putting out the footage of his martyrdom. And then to see Al-Hadath or the other Saudi Al-Arabiya or other Saudi outlets trying to diminish him, or Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah or Sayyid Hashim Safiuddin or other or Ismail Haniyeh and other leaders of the resistance, that are not going to go down well among Saudis. They see the Israeli regime is for what it is. They see the resistance as legitimate, and they see the Saudi government taking a completely different stance. So I think the Saudis are very vulnerable. The fact that they bound themselves to the West makes them increasingly vulnerable, but they have improved ties with Iran and other non-Western countries for the reasons that I said. But I believe that the further things move forward, the situation is only going to get more dangerous for regional regimes that have done nothing for the Palestinian cause or who stood with the Israeli regime. As I may have said before, it's like if you look at the Persian Gulf or the Caspian Sea or the Mediterranean, and everything seems nice and calm, but underneath there are powerful currents that we don't see. And I think that when we look at this region, this is potentially the calm before the storm, despite all the war and the genocide. But it could be, there could be a big storm ahead. And if there is, then I think the West will lose everything very swiftly. So Saudi Arabia is in a very, very difficult situation. Although I'm pretty sure that they don't see it that way. Because I think the people at the top, if they did, they would never allow their media to speak out against the resistance. They would never allow their media to attack the martyrs of the resistance. They would at least give lip service and do nothing else. Sort of like the president of Turkey. He continues to sell, you know, oil from Baku. Aliyev's oil goes, you know, cheap oil goes to Israel through Turkey. And Turkish goods still go to the Israeli ports through Greece. So he's still doing business, he has ties, but he'll make a strong speech now and then calling, you know, Netanyahu something nasty. And the Saudis should at least be doing that. But I think that the fact that they're not is probably, and I'm guessing, of course, is probably because the people at the top are not being fed proper information. And why do I say that? Because if Mohammed bin Salman had people around him to give him proper advice, he would not have taken the Lebanese prime minister and beat him up. He would not have imposed a siege on Qatar. He would not have murdered my colleague, my friend, Jamal Khashoggi, even though we had many differences, the way he did. He would not have engaged in a genocidal war on Yemen. He wouldn't have done any of these things. And I think the very fact that he did all of these things is probably because people around him are yes men, and they won't tell him what he needs to hear. And that's why I think that Saudi media is making these huge mistakes.
Can you talk about what's going on right now in Kazan, which is so important when it comes, we've learned that one of the very important news that came out from this Kazan, that Pepe Escobar reported that the differences between China and India, that border issue that they had, they're coming to a solution, which is so important for breaks for these two countries. And we are seeing some sort of behavior that we haven't seen before in the West. They understand their differences. They put aside their differences to work with each other for a greater good. Right now, we are witnessing that Russia and Iran gonna sign a comprehensive agreement. And right now, in your opinion, in the eyes of Iranian government, the new Iranian government, how important is BRICS and what they would expect from BRICS to bring to the Iranian economy in terms of, you know, Iran is under tremendous sanctions from the West, more than 40 years, they're trying to destroy Iranian economy. What the Iranians are expecting from this new attitude on the part of BRICS, because they're trying to make a new financial system for the BRICS. How do they see right now the BRICS?
Well, this partial rapprochement between India and China, I think, is extremely important because India's relationship with the West, as we all know, is different. And the fact that the Indians and the Chinese have moved in that direction, we have to see how far they go, of course. But the fact that they have taken these steps, I think, shows that India, too, sees that it cannot put all its eggs in the Western basket, in the basket of the United States, especially because, you know, they're losing in Ukraine. Israel is not doing well. Initially, after about a year ago, the mood in India was, from my understanding, pro-Israel. But then as more and more images came out of Gaza and people saw the genocide, many have gone quiet. Now, some say some people secretly support Israel, but they can't say it because it looks so bad. So I don't know where public opinion stands, but for sure, but things have changed. And Israel, of course, is diminished as a power anyway. It's no longer that myth about the Israeli regime is gone. So India is no longer, I think, the fact that they've come to this agreement with the Chinese means that the Indians want to hedge their bets, as they say. I'm not a betting man, but that's what they say. So I think that's huge. That's very important. But with regards to Iran, this is, again, a sign of how stupid the West is. When President Pezeshkian was elected, he spoke about trying to improve ties with the West. Now, some people like me are more skeptical. Some people like Dr. Zarif are more optimistic. And some people are very skeptical. You know, like there's a group called the Pai Dari, very skeptical. I'm sort of skeptical, but, you know, I don't think either side is, one side is bad or one side is good. I think they have to cooperate together to push the country forward. But in any case, President Pezeshkian made positive noise, and the Europeans could have taken advantage of that. So what did the Israeli regime do? They went and murdered Ismail Haniyeh, a personal guest of President-elect Pezeshkian, hours after his inauguration speech, where they hugged each other. And then when the Iranians took this to the UN Security Council, the West, the collective West, they supported Israel. They supported this assassination. For us, Ismail Haniyeh is a great friend, a martyr, a great martyr, like Yahya Sinwar, like Sayyid Hashim Safieddine, you know, like Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. And the West slapped the new administration in the face. And then after the Israeli regime carried out this assassination, the Iranians said, we're going to respond, because Iran has to respond. Otherwise, Netanyahu will attack again. Deterrence has to be created. So the West, the United States, sent messages that we're going to establish a ceasefire. I was skeptical. Many others were skeptical. But in any case, a decision was made in Iran to hold back. And there is a lot of logic to it, and I agree with it to a large degree, that if the Iranians had struck during the negotiations, then the West Americans and the Israeli regime would have said, oh, we were on the verge of a deal, and then it was about to happen, and lives were about to be saved. But these evil Iranians, they never cared about the Palestinian people. They are, you know, and then the regional media would say, oh, these Shia or the Persians, or, you know, they want Sunnis killed, or they want Arabs killed, or they would, you know, because they're all in the same camp. Even some of the media that is sympathetic to the Palestinians, they're not really in the resistance camp. If they were, the Americans would teach them a lesson. You know, but anyway, I don't want to go too far down that road. But if they really supported the resistance in their media, like let's say Turkish media, if official Turkish media supported the resistance, supported Hezbollah, supported Hamas in a big way, then people would start saying, well, why aren't you involved? So they're going to stay ambivalent. So if Iran struck the Israeli regime, have no doubt that all the Western media and the regional media would suddenly say, Iran, you know, they're bad faith actors. We were about to save lives, but it was these nasty and evil Iranians and the resistance, and they were never sincere. So Iran said, we'll wait. Now, some would say that after it was clear that the negotiations had failed, Iran should have struck. I don't want to get into that. I'm not privy to that sort of the discussions that have taken place about Iran's strike, so I can't comment on that. But the point is that the Americans lied to President Pezeshkian, and President Pezeshkian said that in public. He said they lied to us. So the West, if they really want to deal with Iran, if they want better relations with Iran, why do they keep slapping the president and his administration in the face? And we know that the West has never, and especially the United States, they're unreliable. They, in the nuclear deal, Obama lied. Then Trump tore the deal. Biden, when Biden was elected, I was invited to a very important, back then it was Corona, so it was online. I was invited to two very important think tanks in the United States to discuss a nuclear deal. One was right after inauguration, and one was right before inauguration. The same organization, like a month or two apart. Before the inauguration, these people who are now all very important people in the government, many of them went into government after he came to power. They were saying in the online meeting that yes, as soon as Biden becomes president, he's going to sign an executive order and remove all those sanctions. And I said, he won't. And I said, look, you all live there, you're in the political establishment, and I'm saying here from Tehran that he won't do that. And then after he came to power, there was another meeting a few weeks later, a couple of months later, I don't remember exactly. And there are a couple of other Iranians who were also online, one in the house and another one who was participating elsewhere, one who was near me listening in. And I said, remember what you were saying? Why did I say he's not going to sign the presidential decrees and remove the sanctions because the United States is not sincere. The United States is dishonest. As soon as Biden comes to power, the first thing he's going to do is say, no, no, let's keep those sanctions and see what more we can get from the Iranians. Because that's American exceptionalism. They don't believe they have to abide by commitments. They don't believe that they have to be honest. They don't believe that they need to be reliable. They're America. We are Americans. We're above the law. But being above the law is fine in the 1990s. When you're someone once called it the hyperpower, and after 9/11, someone called the U.S. the hyperpower. When you're by far the number one power, yes, you can do that. But when the world changes and you go down, and the reason why you do go down, by the way, is because of these policies, but that aside, in today's world, you can't do that anymore. So the Americans lied with the Russians over Minsk. So did the Europeans. They lied to the Iranians about the negotiations. They lied about the JCPOA. They're constantly being dishonest. And in with the new administration, the new administration was showing good faith. Some people, I know, I've seen people online attacking President Pezeshkian, saying that he's too naive. I don't really accept a lot of that. President Raisi also said the same sort of thing. President Pezeshkian and President Raisi him in the past and President Pezeshkian today have to be showing the world that we're willing to solve problems with the West. Only a fool would say, no, we are not going to solve any problem. Maybe President Pezeshkian made a mistake here or President Raisi made a mistake there. But in general, I think that the international community, when they see that the problem the international community, what they see that it's the United States that's the problem, it's good for Iran. True, if Iran's guard goes down, that is an unforgivable mistake. Some make that claim that was the case, and I don't know, because I think a lot of this is just politics, and so I don't like to get involved in things that I don't know. But I think it's the right thing to do to say that, look, we are ready for a deal. That's what, when I was in Vienna and Dr. Bogarty 2 years ago, 2.5, 3 years ago, was negotiating the nuclear deal. The intention was to have a deal, but also to show the world that we are willing to have a deal. But we're not going to just accept what the Americans want. We made a mistake in 2015. We didn't have enough safeguards to protect the deal because the Americans were going to be dishonest. We learned our lesson, and we, from now on, we're going to negotiate more carefully with the Americans. That's what was happening 3 years ago. That was President Raisi. Right now, President Pezeshkian did the same thing. He showed goodwill, but the Americans slapped him in the face. Not once, but at least twice. These are two examples that I gave. So I think that in the end, President Pezeshkian can say that I tried, but look at what the Americans are doing. So if anyone speaks to the Iranians about the Israeli regime or what's Iran's position, Iran says, look, we showed goodwill, but look what the Americans did. They continued to carry out the genocide. So what I think is that BRICS, you know, in a broader sense, BRICS is hope for Iran's future. It is, and what the Americans are doing in Ukraine, in Lebanon, in Gaza and elsewhere, what the West is doing, all of these act as a catalyst. In other words, the West has created BRICS in a way. In a way, it's the West that has created BRICS. The West has created the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. The West has helped create all these institutions where they are excluded. And they are acting as a catalyst to push it forward more rapidly. Iran and Russia are the two key countries that want an alternative financial system because they are the ones who are the two larger powers that are sanctioned. But other countries are worried as well. India's worried. They want to do business with Russia. They don't want to put all their eggs in the American basket. That the discussions between India and China reflect that. So I think that while we shouldn't exaggerate the progress made at in Kazan, and why we should keep in mind, we should recognize that the changes that are taking place are gradual. But I think there is a sense of urgency among countries, China in particular, who knows that if the U.S., the U.S. will increasingly use sanctions against them. So this is creating an opening for Iran. And already Iran is doing a lot better. Someone said to me just a couple of days ago that Biden has been better than Trump because Biden allows Iran to export oil. I said, no, Biden has been enforcing all the sanctions. What happened was that the Raisi government first, they said, we're not going to prioritize the nuclear deal. We're going to find solutions to export our oil and to do business without the nuclear deal. We will negotiate, but we will not wait for a deal. but also it was the war in Ukraine and the United States expanding its conflicts with other countries, with Russia, and that created an energy crisis. And basically, countries like Iran and Venezuela were able to go back on the market because the market needed Iranian oil. It wasn't as if Biden was doing any favors for Iran, not at all. If he could stop Iran from exporting oil, he'd do it today, but it would create a major problem for the United States. And again, the United States is growing weaker and the global majority is growing stronger. So BRICS, we shouldn't exaggerate it's what it's doing right now, but it is a step in the right direction. Kazan, I think, is an important moment. And I think that gradually, and maybe swiftly, it depends. If the economic situation, some people are making predictions about an economic crisis in the United States with all the money that they've printed and the debt that they've accumulated, maybe change will happen more rapidly than we think with regards to the US dollar. There could be a very big crisis, you know, in the near future. But in any case, BRICS is going to bring, from what I'm seeing, BRICS is going to be bring about change. And for Iran, that change is very welcome.
And it seems that even in the mind of Donald Trump, he knows that the power of sanctions is reducing as time goes by, and with the rise of BRICS, and they're coming to some sort of solution, a new SWIFT system. And they know, because he was talking about Iran and Russia recently, he wants a better relationship. We were surprised hearing that. He wants a better relationship between Iran, Russia, and the United States. And it shows that the way that they have been putting pressure on Iran, Russia, all of these, Venezuela, when you look at BRICS, it's unbelievable. It's colorful. You see, these. It's not a club of elites. When you look at G7, it seems some seven countries that there are exceptional. They're the better. They're the most.
The civilized
economies, yeah. But when you look at BRICS, you see all colors together, and you see Venezuela, you see Iran, Russia, India. It's unbelievable that what they're achieving, I think, in the future would be huge, would be huge. And the United States is coming to a moment that they're getting what's going on with BRICS. They were joking about BRICS before. Right now, they're understanding what's going on with BRICS and how powerful they're getting right now.
Yes, and until right before BRICS, they were not even talking about it in the Western media. They've been don't even use the name BRICS in their reporting, but it's there in front of them, and I'm sure that they are calculating what out of that interview that Trump had with that so-called Iranian American. I don't know. But anyway, it's the blind leading the blind. He was more imperialist than Trump was in the discussion. But Trump said the most important thing that Trump said there was, if I'm not mistaken, because I wasn't listening very carefully, actually. But I think Trump said, look, we can't even govern ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the problem that the United States has today. It doesn't matter if it's Harris or Trump. The reality is that the United States can barely govern itself. And after the election, who knows what sort of, depending on the outcome and how it plays out and how close it is, there could be trouble in the United States that makes things even more complicated than them. But the United States cannot govern itself, as Trump said. And this is the key point, which also makes the United States increasingly dangerous, because a collapsing empire could lash out. Because it's very difficult for this collapsing empire to suddenly see all those horrible regimes like Iran thriving, or Russia thriving, or China thriving. And that could be very dangerous, especially as, you know, it's really amazing, Nima. It's very amazing how I've been involved in media by accident. It's a very long story. I'm a very private person. I don't I never even wanted to be a professor at university. I wanted to be in like some office somewhere or in some place, you know, on my own. I was never comfortable in front of classes, let alone audiences. But that's fate. And for years, I've always been trying to defend the Islamic Republic of Iran, and I've always been honest. Everything that I've said is what I have always believed. I believe that Iran is the protagonist, and the United States is the real evil in this relationship. But always, I've had a difficult time, especially when there are riots, or, for example, Mahsa Amini, when she passed away. We saw a global effort, big tech, and, you know, to demonize. We had all these singers and actors and dancers and actresses and whoever, you know, coming out against Iran. All of them, of course, quiet when it comes to genocide and Holocaust. But anyway, and I knew that Iran had a high degree of legitimacy inside the country, that I knew there was no evidence that Mahsa Amini was murdered, that she was beaten. But all that aside, the real reason actually was because a lot of young people in Iran, between the ages of 15 to 21, maybe at most, especially after Corona, they came to this belief that the problem is Iran. Really, it didn't have anything to do with Mahsa Amini as an individual. It had to do with something much bigger. There was a large segment of young Iranians who believed that, look, you are the problem. The West wants peace and friendship and democracy and freedom, and you are just looking for trouble. That has changed. My own students who participated, some of them, in the protests or the riots or whatever, their views have changed. Across the world, the views have changed. People come to me and say, you know, they say, please, you know, as if I have some sort of authority, hit Israel hard, you know, save the Palestinians. And of course, Iran is doing a lot more than Iran is doing things that we'll only find out in a few years. How much Iran has actually helped Gaza, how much Iran has helped the resistance across the board or the West Bank. But, you know, that will be for the years to come. But people across the world are now looking. When Ayatollah Khamenei went and said Friday prayers, people contacted me. People who used to attack him contacted him once, and I wept. So the Americans have destroyed their image. It's not just a declining economy. It's not just a declining military. But it's the image of the West that pretended to be about freedom and fairness and democracy and all that, that's gone. And now those countries that have been antagonized are gathering together in a club and that's saying, let's do business together without the Americans, without the Europeans. We don't need them. And then people are saying, look, the Iranians and others, they're the good guys. Many are saying the Russians are the good guys. The Lebanese are the good guys. The Palestinians are the good guys. Who has brought about this more than anyone else? The United States and its Western allies. They were the ones who created this situation. They undermined themselves. They can't blame Iran and Russia for interfering in U.S. affairs and elections. The reality is that they've undermined themselves. But they will not be able to acknowledge that, because they see themselves as superior, and they cannot see themselves for what they really are, these elites, as genocidal maniacs that are working against the interests of their own people, let alone the interests of the international community.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor Morandi, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
It was a great pleasure being with you. Thank you.
Thank you.